that's a three-word study. Who would say that total?
I'll make three.
Oh, okay. Three and a half.
Are you still great to have it?
Is this Creek Word City?
Oh, that was pretty good.
Better be a Creek Word City, starting to love the show. I mean, it's been a hard enough morning without just being in totally the wrong classroom. Hey Dale, how are you doing? Got a roll sheet here. This one in column one. If you would. Well, this is Greek Word Studies, and give you a brief introduction, give you an idea of what we're trying to do. We want to see the what we could describe as powerful illustrative pictures that are provided in the New Testament by the Greek language. The Greek language is pictorial in a sense, and through those pictures, through those illustrations, there's a great deal that we can learn. The class is meant to be a spiritual blessing, more or less. We're not really dealing with that much theologically. It's to show you the richness of the New Testament. That's the real purpose of it. There's no translation of the Greek New Testament that is able to bring out everything that there is to the Greek language. Kenneth Wiest does by far the best job in expanding the Greek language in English, but even that has its limitations. It has limitations in his own personal theology, and it has limitations because he has limited space. He can only use a certain number of words. The concepts in the Greek conveyed, brought over into the English, they're too full. They're too complete. There's just too much to it. So there's no translation that can really do the Greek language justice. If you have New American Standard, Rotherham, Kenneth Wiest, and a couple of interlinears, and you compare all of those, and maybe throw in a few other translations besides, usually you begin to get a pretty good picture. But even that is not complete. There are delicate shades of meaning, vivid word pictures, and there's various language idioms. And all of those, to put that into English, is pretty hard. It's not a very easy task. The people that have the idea will now say, oh, you learn Greek, and then anybody can make a translation. That poor guy's head's not quite screwed on straight. There's too much involved. Undertaking a translation is a huge, what a task. I would never want to be involved in such a thing. A.T. Robertson, in his word study, and he titles his word study, Word Pictures in the New Testament, he says that it's entitled this way because the language was originally purely pictographic, all dealing with pictures. And that's what we're going to see. We're going to be dealing with pictures. And that's what's conveyed in the Greek language over and over again. And I think this is extremely important because pictures help to form the right concepts. And I've learned this in teaching Tabernacle and in other classes with typology. Those pictures, those historical examples, are absolutely invaluable as far as our being able to understand what God is really saying. There's so much more that you can understand in those pictures that words by themselves, theology by itself, doesn't convey. So dealing with the Greek language in this way is, in a sense, almost like dealing with typology, because you're dealing with pictures. And what is really shown in that picture? What is the application of that picture? What's the meaning of that picture? We can see that these words in the Greek language are rich with meaning, and they speak to us with lively images. And these images convey the concepts that really allow us to understand what God is talking about. So I think it's very, very important. In John chapter 6 and verse 63, he says that his words are spirit and life. It shows that they're living. They were meant to impart broad concepts. They were meant to impart revelation. They were meant to impart understanding. The letter can't really do that. If you just have dead letter, it's not enough. If we just had the Ten Commandments, it wouldn't be enough to walk with God. We need it illustrated. And we don't need it illustrated once. About 5 million plus a few million more illustrations just begins to help us. We need things pictured in as many different ways as possible so that we begin to catch on. It's not an easy thing. God, indwelling a spiritual heavenly realm, comes down as it were to this earthly realm, trying to elevate us up to his spiritual realm so that we can be walking in the Spirit and having a close, intimate relationship with him. But we're so earthbound. We're so tied to these bodies of flesh. And here he uses languages of men to try to get us up into our heavenly citizenship. It's quite a task. It's quite a problem. It's not an easy thing to deal with. So God has taken this language, which is extremely expressive, to help give us further pictures that allow us to come to a deeper understanding of what God really wants to accomplish. I wouldn't say necessarily that God was the direct author of Greek, nor would I necessarily say that God was the direct author of Hebrew. We don't know the full development of these languages, but at the time, we see that God did allow Alexander the Great to conquer the known world, and the influence of the Greek culture still remained even after Greece was conquered by Rome. The Hellenization was still predominant, and Greek pretty much was a world language at that time, and so God used that as the vehicle, and it is a very expressive language, so I think we see God's hand involved there. How fully and to what degree, there's no way of really saying, though. We can have an opinion. One person will say, well, I think it shows absolutely, and blah, blah, blah. But who can really say for sure? A couple of general points about New Testament Greek. It's Koine Greek, K-O-I-N-E. And that's a long E. It's an Ada, Koine, K-O-I-N-E. And it was the common language of the day. We can say that to some degree God guided its development so as to be a rather perfect vehicle. I wouldn't say absolutely perfect, but a rather perfect vehicle for handling the revelation of God in word, revelation of the New Testament. You'll find that some of the scholars, I think they're a little bit too caught up with Greek, and they describe it in such glowing terms, really giving almost the impression that it was heaven sent. I really wouldn't go that far. I'd stand back from that enthusiasm, just a few paces, and reconsidered a little bit. I wouldn't say that it was a perfect vehicle. I don't think any language of man after the fall could be categorized as a perfect vehicle. But maybe at the time, Greek was the best available. I think we do see God's hand involved, but as I said, to what degree, there's really no way of being able to determine. This language was known and understood worldwide in the known world at that time, which would be going up into parts of Europe, over into parts of Asia, down into Africa, into the known world, the world revolving around the Mediterranean, more or less. And it was known by both the scholar as well as just the common man. It had been a distinct language for over 350 years. And so it was very common. It was used more or less language of the marketplace. And this is because of the influence of Greece from Alexander the Great, described as Hellenism. Now, God, who is the author of both the Old and the New Testament, and we know this very clearly, of course, you can put 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 21, what he did is he took this language and he breathed further life into it, and he breathed further dimension. And so he took words that were common, but he elevated them. So he gave further illustration to these words. So here is a language that was expressive, and he added much more to it. Probably the best example is the word agape for love. It never meant what we see in the Bible until Jesus died upon the cross, until God expressed his love through that sacrifice. There's no way that it could mean what we see in the Bible until that example, because there'd never been such an example. The word agape was just basically the same word that we have, love, which is a very nebulous, ambiguous, very non-definitive term. But when God gave his own son and chose this term, saying, "For God so loved the world," John 3, verse 16, he elevated the word. He gave it a further dimension. He gave it more definition. He added to its concept. Now, I would say that God selected these words that we find in the New Testament with infinite reason and infinite purpose. So he's chosen certain words, and he chose those out of the Greek language. He put those in the New Testament. Some he elevated, some he left basically as they were. But he chose them with his own knowledge, his own understanding. There are many other words that he could have used, but he chose these words. So I think that there's much to be gained by studying the various words that God has used. I don't think it was arbitrary in any sense. We're going to have some tests in the class and some quizzes. I might give you a couple of assignments, but we'll talk about those later on. I will give you basically a list of references that you can consult on your own if you want to do Greek word studies. You don't have to know the Greek language. You just have to use these references carefully. And you also have to have a pretty good understanding of your own theology, because your own theology is a tremendous safety. It's your safeguard in dealing with these words. Your theology is very, very important. Some people, they want to put aside their theology when they're studying, but you've got to keep your theology ever present. It's very, very important. It's a safeguard. There's numerous lexicons. There's Moulton and Milligan. Just spell these as best as you can. I'm sure they won't be too offended. Moulton and Milligan. And they deal with Greek words that are used in the New Testament, but they give the usage from extra-biblical writings. So they don't give you any of the verses where the word is used in the New Testament. They just give you how the word is used in various extra-biblical documents, like business ledgers, letters, other things that they found where biblical words are used outside of the Bible, and they show the meaning from these outside usages. So it can be a very helpful and interesting source. There's Bauer, Arndt, and Gingrich, just B-A-G, and then just a standard lexicon. There's Liddell and Scott. So Bauer, Arndt, and Gingrich, Liddell and Scott. There's also a lexicon by Abbott and Smith. These are just standard lexicons. And then there's also Thayer's lexicon. So Moulton, Milligan, Bauer, and Gingrich, Liddell and Scott, Abbott and Smith, and Thayer's. And there's also concordances that can be used that are helpful. Young's Concordance will give very brief definition. Strong's will give still brief, but a little bit more adequate definition. Then there's a concordance by Smith. It's an analytical concordance. It's set up quite a bit different than the others. And it's worthwhile to note in some cases. And then probably the most informative of the concordances is Englishman's, Greek concordance. And this will give you the particular Greek word, no matter how it's been translated in the New Testament, all listed together. So it's a concordance by the Greek word, not by the English translation. And really, if you're ever doing a Greek word study, this should be really your first source, should be Englishman's Greek concordance. Then there's various word studies. There's Kittles, and he was the editor, and he wasn't the editor for all of it, but for part of it. It's extremely liberal, extremely verbose. I mean, you talk about wordy. It is wordy. There's a newer one, I believe that it's edited by Colin Brown, and Dictionary of New Testament Theology, something like that. And it is really good. I think it's an excellent source. It's set up very much like Kittles, but it's much more concise. So it's by Brown. He's the editor of it. It's a three-volume work. I'm really impressed with it. I think it's an excellent source. There's also Vincent's Greek Word Study. He deals a lot more with the etymology of the word, the history of the words. A.T. Robertson, he deals much more with parts of speech. Vincent, A.T. Robertson, they're relatively dull. I mean, they give you more of the intricacies of the language itself. They didn't have too much spiritual illumination shining on their pens, evidently, or else they felt a particular call of God toward boredom. Seems like... they'll have to forgive me when I see him up on the other side of the pearly gates. Let's see if we can get this part of the tape erased before I see him. There's Kenneth Wiest, which is by far the most spiritual of all the word studies. He was a Calvinist. He's anti-tons. But my, what spirituality in his word study. If you want to see concisely what we're trying to do here, read through parts of his word study, because that's what we want to do here. Bring life to the Greek words. He does just absolutely outstanding job. And generally, his theology doesn't hinder anything that he has to say. The only sad part is that he wasn't able to finish the New Testament. But it's just it's absolutely outstanding, as far as I'm concerned. Then there's single-volume paperback books that deal with various Greek words. And these are very worthwhile, extremely limited because they only deal with a select number of words, and so if they deal with a word that you're interested in, it's you've had some good fortune. If they don't, it's pretty much par for the course, but when they do, they're usually helpful. One is by a man named Barclay, and it's quite well done. A bit shallow, but still worthwhile. Then there's one by a man named Tolle, T-O-L-L-E, and I think he has two volumes, just small paperbacks. And then there's other ones as well like this. I think we have a couple on the book counter, Gems from the Scriptures or something like that. Also, you have Vines, and you should always consult Vines just because it's very simple, easy to use. But with Vines, you should always look at Bullinger's. It's set up in very similar manner, but usually Bullinger's is more concise. In my opinion, not only more concise, but more precise. I think he does a better job. Sometimes it's hard in reading through Vines. He's got a lot of information, but it's sometimes difficult to figure out what he's talking about. But if you read both of these, it's usually a good beginning. And if you compare Englishman's Greek Concordance with this information, it's a good foundation to work from. There's also Trench's book on synonyms, Synonyms of the New Testament by Trench, which is a little bit outdated, but still worthwhile to look at. And then there's various commentaries that you could also consult as well. Doing a Greek word study is time-consuming. It's not going to take 3.5 minutes. It might take more like 3.5 hours. That is, if you do a thorough job. And that's what you really have to be concerned with, is being careful, being thorough. Most anyone can do a Greek word study if they'll take their time. If you're in a hurry and you're going to jump to conclusions and make large assumptions, well, then it's a rather dangerous thing to do. That's why, again, your theology is important. You need to have good theology so that you won't be coming up with some new doctrines on the nature of God and some new things about speaking in tongues and speaking in tongues out of your ear and things like that. I mean, because of a preposition or something. I mean, no telling what people will come up with. People will come up with things that are just absolutely nonsensical, but they're convinced that it's right. And they'll appeal to the Greek and say it's because of this tense, it's because of this usage. You have to be very, very careful. Let me talk to you briefly about prepositions. And then we'll get started. There are quite a number of Greek prepositions, and each one has a primary meaning. And you should always use the primary meaning as step number one. You should not go to resultant alternative meanings unless absolutely necessary. The prepositions are also often used as prefixes. And when they are used as a prefix to a word, they form, obviously, a compound word. But it's for emphasis. It's to modify. It's to intensify the meaning of the verb or the noun. Sometimes you use a prefix to a verb, sometimes a prefix to a noun. And it's to modify, to intensify, as well as to emphasize. It adds further stress to the word. You might have this verb used by itself in another place, it has a preposition prefix to it. It adds to it. It intensifies it. It further emphasizes it. It's putting more stress upon that word in this particular verse, in this particular statement. I would recommend that if you do not have the Kingdom Interlinear, that you buy one. Or, at best, you borrow one and copy their diagram for prepositions. And it's a very simple diagram. And basically, it appears like this. And it has, it's actually a circle. And then it has various lines showing these various prepositions as to their meaning, and it gives them illustrated. And you should have this available so that when you're doing Greek word studies or just studying various verses, and there's prepositions, that you always have these main meanings available and this illustration, because it's very, very helpful. It pictures the meaning, and that it shows the concept of the Greek language. It's pictures. There's a few other prepositions that are not found on this chart, and I want to give those to you. And the three other prepositions of note, the first one, opiso, and you will have to pardon my pronunciation of Greek. It will be poor, if not worse, primarily giving you spellings. If you want to become a master of Greek pronunciation, well, then that's between you and God. God hasn't called me to that yet, so I'm still laboring with my my American Greek pronunciation, so you'll have to bear with that. Some of you might find it hard to tolerate, but just the best I can do, brethren, the best I can do. So this first one, opiso, O-P-I-S-O, and the last O is omega, so it's a long O, and it means behind. And then the preposition anti, or anti, A-N-T-I, and this means against or face to face. A-N-T-I, against or face to face. And then the third one is soon, S-U-N, means together with. S-U-N, together with. So those are three other prepositions of note. If you want further information, Dana and Manti, they have a lengthy section on prepositions, pages 96 to 115. Pages 96 to 115. Okay, the first word that we'll look at, actually two words, the word diadema and Stephanos. D-I-A D-E-M-A, and it's a long E, diadema, and then Stephanos, S-T-E-P-H-A-N-O-S, S-T-E-P-H-A-N-O-S, diadema, Stephanos. Now, the word diadema is derived from the word diadeo, D-I-A-D-E-O, diadeo, and it's a long O. And diadeo means to bind around, to bind around. So diadema came to refer to the kingly ornament for the head. The kingly ornament for the head. And we find that among both the Greeks and the Romans, it was the distinctive badge of royalty. So it emphasizes royalty. So that's a primary picture, royalty. It also conveyed the concept and showed forth that this person had the power to rule. So it was a symbol of that. It showed that this person had power to rule. The person occupied a place of royalty, and the royalty gave him power and authority. This wasn't, didn't have the idea of the person was just some sort of a figurehead. He wasn't just a puppet in rulership, But he was the ruler. He was the royalty. He was the king. He was the ruler. And as the ruler, he had power. He had authority. So that was the basic concept of diadema. Then the word Stephanos, literally it means that which surrounds or encompasses. That which surrounds or encompasses. And it comes from the Greek word stepho. S-T-E-P-H-O. S-T-E-P-H-O. And that's a long O, stepho. And stepho means to encircle. Now the word Stephanos is used in a number of ways. It means a wreath or a circlet that was worn on the head as the prize for victory. So in some sort of a race, maybe in some sort of a battle, the victor would be given this Stephanos. It shows victory. It was a prize. So it was a wreath or a circlet worn on the head. It was also a festal ornament worn on the head during a time of celebration, during a time of festivity, during a time of joy. The great joy, great celebration. And during that time, they would wear Stephanos, a wreath on the head. So all of that is part of the picture. So you take this information, and then you see how it's used in the scriptures, and it gives you a picture, it gives you a concept that is much more full than just wreath or crown. That's the whole purpose of the class, is to show you these more complete, fuller concepts. Another way that Stephanos was used is that it was given as a public honor for distinguished service or for personal worth. Given as a public honor for distinguished service or personal worth. So if somebody had, lived a distinguished life, they'd been involved in some sort of heroic act, maybe in the town, some sort of a civic deed, or they were just a person that everybody else liked and they wanted to honor. There were times when they would be given a Stephanos, given this wreath. Now, overall, it shows recognition of accomplishment and victory. Those are the two things, accomplishment and victory. And with accomplishment and victory, there's always celebration. So it's always emphasizing joy. Celebrating. With every victory, there's celebration. With every accomplishment, there's celebration. Now the overall underlying meaning of diadema is the recognition of the right to rule. So diadema shows that there's the recognition of the right to rule. And with Stephanos, as I just mentioned, it's accomplishment and victory. So you have this recognition of the right to rule, having authority and power. And then you have accomplishment and victory. So let's see how we use this in the New Testament. I'll just look at these quickly. No need to turn to them. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 3. Revelation 12:3. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, And behold, a great red dragon having seven heads and ten horns and seven crowns upon his heads. Diadema. He was given the right to rule. And this is being acknowledged by God. And it should be acknowledged by the saints. The Antichrist, the world government, the false prophet, that whole world system will be given a right to rule. It'll be a limited right for a limited period of time. But it's a right given by God. God allows it. It doesn't show accomplishment and victory because it won't end in that. It's going to end in defeat. But there has been given the right to rule. And it will happen. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 25. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 25. See, part of what's important for us in this class is to learn that God used different terms, but in English, when you translate it, it's hard to denote the difference between the terms. If you make one wreath and the other crown, that doesn't show anything to us. We don't have in our minds a concept of some sort of great distinction and difference between wreath and crown. It doesn't make that much difference in our language. But in their language, diadema and Stephanos means two different things. So here, with the English language, where we're very limited in translating the Greek, we use pretty much crown for both words, so therefore we lose much of what he was really saying. So now we can go back and find out the underlying meanings and concepts in these terms and find out where they're used. Then it's going to show us something. It's going to show us that God was much more particular in the words that he was choosing than what most people think. And then that's going to help us in other points of theology. We can illustrate it with the term baptizo as compared to rontizo, immersion, sprinkling. Well, with these other examples, it adds weight to that. Somebody said, well, it doesn't mean that much. That's just one single example. You're making too much out of that. But as you go through the New Testament, you find it thousands of times. Great distinction in terms. This term was used and not this one. This was used and this one's never used. It's showing us different things. There's a reason behind it. God is offering it. He's trying to say something. He's trying to illustrate something. He's trying to make a particular point. So I think that's very valuable for us. And if you come to understand that, you'll put more time into finding out these differences on your own. You'll be doing more study in these areas. And as I said, you don't have to be a Greek scholar. All you have to do is really be careful and know basically how to use the references that are available to us. Okay, 1 Corinthians 9:25, and every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible, Stephanos. A crown showing accomplishment. A crown showing victory. We want an incorruptible Stephanos that shows that we have accomplished the will of God. That we have attained the victory that God has for us to attain. Revelation 19:12. Revelation 19:12. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, and he had a name written that no man knew but he himself. Upon his head were many diadems, diadema. It shows the fullness of Christ's right to rule. The Antichrist has just finished contesting that right, and now he's been totally defeated. Christ comes and he shows forth that it is his right totally and fully to rule upon earth. It's not just coming to show victory, that's what's involved in the rulership. The emphasis is on the rulership. The right to rule. Who really has the right to rule upon earth? The Creator himself. God manifest in the flesh. You can put also with that First Corinthians 15:25 and Philippians 2, verses 9 to 11. Just emphasizing this fullness of rulership. Another reference, 1 Peter 5 and verse 4. 1 Peter 5 and verse 4. And when the chief shepherd shall appear, ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away. This is a crown of accomplishment, Stephanos. It's going to be a crown of victory. You talk about a victory celebration. It's going to be quite a thing when man finally stands before God and realizes that it hasn't in any way been a fantasy. I mean, no matter how much faith we have and how real it seems, heaven and eternity still occupies somewhat a realm of fantasy. It's just too much. It's, you know, you say, I really believe it. I know that it's going to be, and still, wow, it's too immense for us. It's much like the pretty lady who's about to be married. I mean, it still seems like it's eternity away, but the day will finally come. And even when the day comes, she has to pinch herself to make sure that it's not a dream. Like when I was a small boy, every year as we go through September, October, November, December, Christmas, you know, it just seemed like it would never come. It was still in my mind just a fantasy, and the beautiful tree and all these presents. It was just such a great time, but it seemed like it would never come. But every year it came. Well, really, that's the way heaven will be. The day is, it's not that far away, and it'll be a day of tremendous victory, tremendous celebration, and we'll be given a crown of glory, a Stephanos of glory. It's going to happen. It's really going to take place. And God wants to make it much more of a reality to us as we continue to walk with Him. And then Revelation 13:1. And now we just see with the Antichrist that this rulership has become, you might say, it's actually moved into the position of ruling. Because here we see that the horns now have crowns upon them, and the horns emphasize power, and these crowns are diadems, diadema, and so now it's emphasizing that he really has moved into the full position of ruling upon earth and bringing the destruction that he will bring. And this, of course, is following the rapture. It says, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy." And that's the way his rulership will be. It'll be a rulership of blasphemy. It'll be anti-God. It'll be anti-Christ. It'll be opposite, against in every sense. It'll be a counterfeit, but yet still opposite, against God. But it will be rulership, and it's a rulership that is allowed. God does allow it, but it will not bring accomplishment, and it will not bring victory. Because the accomplishment and the victory and the celebration are all positive things. They're not negative. Now, diadema is used only 3 times in the New Testament. It's interesting that it's used twice in reference to the Antichrist system. It's only used once in reference to Christ. It's only used 3 times. And the right of rulership that we have is only in Christ. It never talks about the saints having diadems. It talks about the Antichrist system and Christ. I'm glad that we see that Jesus, he has the final right to rule. I'm glad we see that. It's comforting, very comforting. Now for just a few more moments, we'll talk about the word Stephanos. Now this is used always by Paul. It's not just used by him, but in his writings, as the Holy Ghost was inspiring him to write, it's used of the conqueror, the one who is victorious, the one who does battle and comes out with a victory. So this, it must be a very important concept. if this is how it's used over and over again, dealing with victory, but you don't have victory without battle. So it must be important from God's mind for us to see that there's going to be battle. It must be vital. This victor's wreath was placed on Jesus' head in mockery. In Matthew 27 and verse 29, they mocked him here. They didn't understand what they were really doing. They didn't understand that through this awful death, victory would be accomplished. They didn't even understand that. They did something mocking God, mocking Christ, and God would turn it around. Matthew 27, verse 29, and when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they'd made a crown, a Stephanos of thorns, they put it upon his head, and a reed in his right hand, that was to be a staff. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. There'll be a day that they say that. There won't be mockery then. They'll see that he has a total victory. And they'll understand, they'll look back and see that by Christ's death, that is what has wrought the victory. Without the death of Christ, there'd be no victory. Without the resurrection of Christ, there'd be no victory. See, carnal and rebellious man did not realize the great victory that God would bring through his only begotten son's death. Carnal man didn't understand that. Rebellious man didn't understand it. It's much the same thing that happens with us in our walk with God. We don't always recognize the means by which God will bring victory. We mock God's hand upon our lives at times. We look at the very thing that God is going to use to bring victory and we scorn it. We later repent of that, of course. We're not always so observant. We're not always so sensitive to what is really taking place. A trial comes that will work to bring invaluable good to us, and we mock it. We scorn it. We belittle it. We turn away from it. We don't want it to work. But we learn later on that it's only through this that we will come out victorious. The trials are necessary. It's just normal procedure for carnal man, though, to look upon the things of God and scorn them and mock them. It's a very common procedure. Because of Christ, we can receive this crown. It's another connection here. Without Christ dying, there'd be no crown for us. We do not gain the victory in our own strength. We're not going to be able to say, this is our accomplishment. It will not be our accomplishment. It'll be his accomplishment in us. The following references that I'll give you here show when it's bestowed and what conditions are to be met before receiving this crown. I'll give you the verses and then I'll just list out the when and the conditions. 1 Corinthians 9, verses 24 to 27. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 8. Also, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 19. James chapter 1 and verse 12. 1 Peter 5 and verse 4. And then in the book of Revelation, chapter 2, verse 10. And chapter 3, verse 11. Now, in these verses, it tells us both when and the conditions. It's going to be bestowed, first of all, at that day. So dealing with when, it says at that day. It's rather ambiguous because it refers to a number of different days. At the day of the rapture, at the day of the second coming, at the day of the final resurrection, at the day of the new heavens and the new earth. We want it to be at the day of the rapture. That's what we are preparing for. We want it to be at the day when the bride meets the bridegroom. But if not, it might be at the day of the martyrdom of the Laodicean saints in the Great Tribulation. I would prefer that that not be the case. Personally, I don't really look forward to that. Previous would be much better to me. Former. Also, it says when the chief shepherd appears. He's going to appear at the rapture. He's going to appear at the second coming. I'd like it to be when he appears at the rapture. It also says, after enduring temptation, being tried, but enduring the temptation. When are you going to receive it? After enduring temptation. After enduring testing. After doing battle. This is an army that's going to have to do battle. We're going through boot camp preparation. I think more people need to realize that this is not a game. Soldiers in boot camp, it's hard for them to realize that it's not a game. But they learn real quick that it's not a game. After all the training, and they finally are out on the battlefield, and it's real ammunition, and there's bombs blowing up around them, they realize it's not a game. They don't usually realize it until they're in the battle. Even in all the preparation and all the people and all the men they're preparing them, all they have to say, all the warnings, they're trying to get them prepared, but no matter what they say, it's still hard to get them prepared. But once they're in the battle, they know it's not a game. They know it's for real. It's life or death. After you go through a great test and you realize just how vulnerable you really are and just how much your life hangs in the balance and how much you have to hold on to God, it's no longer a game. For most new Christians, it's just a game. It's just kind of a fun and games thing. It's just kind of exciting. It's just kind of frivolous living. And, oh, isn't this wonderful and joyous? And this is just so bubbly and exciting. But once the trials come, once there's real battle, they kind of stand back, and the sweat pours from their brow, and their hands are shaking, and they're realizing in their heart and their soul and their spirit that, boy, they hang in the balance. It's heaven or hell, and it's not a game. It's God who's for them, the devil who's against them. And they have to decide where they're going to be, what side they're going to be on. But it's not a game. There's going to be a battle. There's going to be testing. There's no crown. There is no crown given without testing. You do not give, you don't give anybody the gold medal in the Olympic Games without the race. Like this lady last year who snuck in at the Boston Marathon, I think it was. fastest time, and then they found out she's a fraud. See? Well, she doesn't get the crown. She doesn't get the medal. She doesn't get the victor's wreath. God knows who tries to sneak in. There's only one way. Anybody else, a thief and a robber, that's exactly what she was. I hope she is the most embarrassed person on the face of the earth. I mean, how anybody can have that kind of a mind? It always was so hard for me to understand how anybody could feel good about winning a game when they cheated. I mean, I just was never that kind of a person. But some people, it's winning, and it doesn't matter what you have to do. But that is just, it just shows how twisted the mind can be. Nobody's going to make it into the bride who isn't really the bride of Christ. We're going to find out where we really stand in God. We can play the game and speak the right words, but God is testing us. He's going to find out who is really accomplishing these things that are called for us to accomplish in the plan of God. It also says that they'll receive when they're faithful unto death. You don't receive until you're faithful unto death. Well, I'm glad that this can refer to dying to self. I'm glad it doesn't have to refer simply to hack, hack, chop, chop, burning up in the flames or what else. See, I'm glad it can refer to dying to self, although at times, I think the other would be much more simple. I don't know how long the pain would be. I haven't tried such things. It's not too much of bringing yourself back if you try it once. So, I mean, I can't speak from any point of experience. But this dying to self, it can be a frustrating process. But you don't get the wreath of accomplishment without the dying to self. Unfortunately, for the Laodiceans, they won't get it until martyrdom. I really think in the long run, the dying to self is the easiest if we would just really appropriate the power of God. Just live the lives of faith that God has shown us to live in His Word. And then one last point here as far as when at Jesus is coming. So there's a great emphasis at that day when the chief shepherd appears at Jesus is coming. There's a great emphasis when He comes. It's emphasizing for us preparing to be the bride of Christ, the rapture. But it shows also there has to be testing. And it shows also there has to be dying to self. There's no other way to get the crown. Now the conditions, it's put a list to the conditions. First of all, you must run in the race. If you don't run in the race, you never get the crown. Well, we kind of like to stand on the sidelines, let the other people run, but we all have to run in the race. Another condition is that we have to actually compete. It is a competition. There must be a competing. We must be involved. Another condition is that we must train. We must prepare. And he talks about preparing to receive a corruptible crown. It is amazing the preparation and the training that people go through for a corruptible crown. It is absolutely phenomenal. We are training for that which is incorruptible. And we need to get this revelation somehow locked into the old brain here, understanding what we're really doing. Another condition is that we must be determined to win. We must be people with conviction, determination. We are going to win. Well, I kind of like to win. I'd rather win than lose. I like the idea of winning. We must be determined to win. Absolutely set in mind and heart that we are going to win and nothing else. Well, there's a few more, and we'll give you these next time. What you need to be doing is, as far as the tests are concerned, it's dealing with all the main concepts of these works, the main spiritual concepts. It's not dealing with all the words that they come from and all sorts of meanings in the classical Greek and all of that, but it's the main spiritual concepts, the main tie-ins, the main truths. And so you need to be studying your notes with that in mind. Okay.
We might have a couple of quizzes.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, not worried about the next class. But.
I love.